This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with Ben Wisner, one of the leaders of the American Civil Liberties Union, on what's going on with the new Trump administration.
Ben will address the serious threats to civil rights and civil liberties in the second Trump administration. Then we'll be joined by Daniel May, the publisher of Jewish Currents magazine, on the identity crisis facing the Jewish left when it comes to the genocide in Gaza.
There's a new regime at the magazine, young people, people in solidarity with the Palestinians.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties. Today, Donald Trump is headed back to the White House, and the nation is preparing for a devastating onslaught of civil rights and civil liberties abuses. Organizing, mobilizing, and resisting is going on all over the country. Within hours after the election, the ACLU made the following announcement, quote, "Starting on day one, we're ready to fight for our civil liberties and civil rights in the courts, in Congress, and in our communities. We did it during his first term, filing 434 legal actions against Trump while he was in office, and we'll do it again. We've done the work, and today our track record shows that we know how to fight his attempts to restrict our civil liberties and civil rights." To learn what the ACLU has planned, we're very pleased to be joined by Ben Wisner, the director of the ACLU's Speech Privacy and Technology Project. For more than two decades at the ACLU, Ben has litigated cases involving the right to protest, freedom of expression online, government surveillance practices, airport security policies, targeted killings, and torture. Since July of 2013, he has been the principal legal advisor to NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden, and I want to add an extraordinary ally in the fight to free Julian Assange. Ben is a graduate of Harvard College and New York University School of Law and was a law clerk to the Honorable Stephen Reinhardt of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. I first met Ben as a young lawyer out here in Los Angeles, and it's a privilege to have watched him lead this cause. Ben, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Steve, it's a great pleasure. As you point out, you and I have known each other for more than 20 years. My first day at the ACLU was in Los Angeles just 5 weeks before the 9/11 attacks. So my short career compared to yours has been full moments of great drama and great peril for civil liberties.
Thank you. The ACLU and the entire nation has already lived through 4 years of Donald Trump. Generally, before we get to specifics, what have we learned from that experience that may better equip us to confront Trump the second time around?
Well, I would say that what we've learned goes far before our experience with Trump. I mean, the ACLU has been around now for more than a century, through 19 presidents, through all manner of civil rights and civil liberties violations, from the internment of U.S. citizens in camps during World War II to the Red Scare, through the post-9/11 era, and of course the first Trump administration. One thing that I think it's important to just say at the outset is that I think we have learned what law can do and what law cannot do. Elections do matter. When the American people elect the same party to hold all three branches of government, they're going to be able to carry out some of their preferred policies. And law is not going to be able to stop them from doing that, except in particular places. The other thing is that law is not a substitute for politics. I think what we saw too much of during the first Trump administration was people hoping that Robert Mueller was going to save us from the Trump nightmare. What we saw too much of in the last 4 years was people thinking that Jack Smith was going to save us from the Trump nightmare. Ultimately, the way that you defeat politics is through politics. Law plays a very particular role, but I hope that people don't think that lawyers are going to be able to solve this problem. Now, what law can do is it can create a lot of friction in the carrying out of abusive policies. It can jump in where what the president is doing is not just unpopular with our side, but actually illegal, that violates the Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights was put in place to protect people from majorities. Right now, we have a political majority that controls all three branches of government, and we are going to need law to step in to protect the powerless, those people who cannot achieve what they need to achieve through the electoral system. And that's going to mean we're going to need to protect non-citizens who, after all, don't have the right to vote. We're going to have to protect religious and racial minorities, as the Bill of Rights does, people who are incarcerated. But we should not expect law to be our savior here. The solution to Trump and Trumpism is going to have to come through organizing and electoral politics.
Ben, let's look at two of the 434 legal actions the ACLU took during Trump's first term. The two that I think you'll agree with me are the areas of the Muslim ban and family separation. And I wanted to ask you what that threat was and how did the ACLU respond?
Well, let's start with the Muslim ban. I think this is almost ancient history at the pace of news these days. But I think this really was one of the most dramatic moments that I've lived through as a lawyer. Remember that just a week after Trump became president in 2017, he signed an executive order that effectively prohibited citizens from Muslim-majority countries from entering the United States for a period of time. And we had been expecting this. We had at that time essentially prepared in advance because Trump had said he was going to do this. And the very same day that Trump signed this executive order, the ACLU was already in court challenging it. And you'll remember that thousands of people were stranded at airports, travelers who were being turned back, people who had been allowed to enter the country but were being turned back by this policy. And it was quite inspiring to see how many Americans went to the airports with signs saying, "We welcome refugees in this country." But we were in court that same night. And the very next day, on the 28th of January, a federal judge in the Eastern District in Brooklyn enjoined that first Muslim ban, essentially said that those people would have to be allowed to enter. This was a very dramatic moment for the country because it showed Trump would not be allowed to rule in a lawless way. I think it actually showed the public how important it was to mobilize. My view is that the tens of thousands of people who went to the airports to protest this created the atmosphere in which that federal judge was able to stand up and strike that down. And so people think sometimes that judges are immune from what's going on in the streets. I think the opposite. I think in this case, the revulsion that the public showed created the necessary atmosphere for that federal judge to issue that ruling. Now, the story unfortunately doesn't end there. Ultimately, there were dozens of different executive orders and travel bans that were put in place as these cases made their way through the courts. And eventually, the Supreme Court sided with the Trump administration in a 5-4 decision in June of 2018, essentially saying that these bans were within the national security powers of the executive branch. So at the end of the day, this was a defeat for our side, but I think it really, in a way, injected so much energy into the legal and political opposition to Trump. For the ACLU, it meant adding hundreds of thousands of new members in a single weekend because people saw that it would be possible to effectively stand up to the Trump administration. Michael, about the grotesque policy of family separation. And of course, this is something that we can expect to see again anytime there's an effort to deport people in a large scale. But it happened when the Trump administration seized on a zero-tolerance policy for violations. Something like 5,000 or 6,000 children, some of them infants, were separated from their parents. And, you know, this tragedy, unfortunately, is not over, despite the legal victories that I'm going to talk about here. We estimate that there might be up to 1,000 children who 7 years later have still not been reunited with their parents, despite our winning in court, despite settlements where the government, you know, agreed to do their best to help us identify parents and children and to bring them back together. But I think the reason why this one also is so important is that I think often people, voters, express support for certain ideas. People should not be here unlawfully. People should not cross the border without legal documentation. People should not work if they don't have authorization to do that. And then once they see the human effect of actually enforcing those policies across the board in a cruel way, it changes their view. I think that the revulsion to seeing young children ripped out of the arms of their mothers and fathers. There were audio recordings that ProPublica obtained from one of these facilities where children were being held that I still can't listen to because it's just too upsetting. When people saw that human cost, it wasn't just the judges that sided with us and said that the Trump administration had acted illegally. It was the public that collectively was repulsed by this and made that known to their leaders in Congress. And so now you hear actually when the incoming Trump administration is asked about family separation, they are on the defensive about it. We can get to what they're saying they're going to do, but they are not proudly saying we're going to separate parents from their children. They are singing a different tune this time. So that was an example of a cruel policy that we were able to effectively challenge in court. But of course, even winning that case, even reuniting thousands and thousands of children with their parents didn't completely solve the problem. As I said before, the separation continues for some families.
Ben, Trump's second term agenda has been foreshadowed by the Heritage Foundation's extreme Project 2025 agenda. In a series of seven memos, the ACLU has detailed the civil rights and civil liberties challenges we're going to be facing and how the ACLU will respond. These areas include immigration, abortion, surveillance, voting rights, LGBTQ rights, the criminal legal system, and DEI and anti-discrimination law. Tell us about those areas and what kind of plan does the ACLU have in effect to confront them?
Well, yeah, thanks for mentioning that. You know, I mentioned before that we were ready in 2017 when Trump took office, but that's only partially true. We had written a report in which we outlined what we expected to be some of the civil rights and civil liberties abuses of a Trump administration, but nothing could really prepare us for the reality of it other than living through it and experiencing it. But I think this time we are much more prepared. Instead of a single memo saying, here's what we think Trump will do, as you outlined, we identified seven areas and wrote lengthy detailed memos. And these are available to anyone who's listening here. I think the easiest way to find it, rather than my reading out a URL, would just be to Google ACLU Trump memos. And that will take you to a page where you can read them all. But we try to predict in these memos, based on what Trump has said, based on what the notorious Project 2025 said, what a Trump administration was likely to do. And then we laid out how we plan to respond with litigation, with advocacy in Congress, and with other kinds of public organizing. Of course, I think no one really expected that Trump would have a unified Republican Congress behind him. And I think we'll have to do some, you know, additional planning now on how to try to throw some sand in the legislative gears as well. But I think what we learned the first time is that we should, in fact, listen very carefully to what Trump and the people around him say they're going to do, and not treat it as hyperbole and not treat it as a bunch of fluff. If you look at some of the personnel decisions that Trump has made and announced in recent days, it's an indication that he intends to govern without advice and consent from the Congress, but just exactly as he pleases. So obviously, the center of Trump's campaign was his promise to deport millions of undocumented immigrants. He has said he's going to ramp up the deportation machine on day one. People around him have said they want to deport 1 million people a year out of the 10 million or so estimated people in this country who don't have legal documentation to be here. Simply put, there is no way to do that without massive violations of the Constitution and federal law. Even non-citizens who are here and who don't have a lawful right to be here do have a lawful right to process. And what we've seen in prior immigration sweeps is that sometimes even citizens get swept up in these things and get deported. When I worked for the ACLU in Los Angeles, colleagues represented U.S. citizens who had been deported to Mexico in these kinds of sweeps. And so therefore, it's important for every single one of these individuals who is subject to removal to have a hearing before an immigration judge, to have an opportunity to challenge that. It's impossible, given the scale and size of our system, the number of judges there are, the number of detention cells, to remove people in any near the numbers that they're saying. So if they're going to actually achieve hundreds of thousands or 1 million a year, they're going to do it by violating the law and constitution. They're going to need to create internment camps because they don't have the detention cells. And we've heard that they've already contacted private prisons to try to contract for more space to hold immigrants. And they're going to have to come up with a theory that allows them to circumvent the due process protections that the Supreme Court has announced for removals. Now, we've heard Trump talking about using an 18th century statute that was passed to deal with invasions from other countries, and it would be flatly unlawful for the administration to rely on a statute like that to engage in mass deportations. But they will surely try and will be ready to challenge that in court. Now, the other thing that we've heard from people around Trump is that they plan to end birthright citizenship. Now, of course, birthright citizenship comes from the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. It's long been understood, not in a partisan way, but by conservative and liberal lawyers and jurists, that anyone born in the United States is a U.S. citizen, even if her parents are not U.S. citizens. And, you know, there are some radical right-wing lawyers who have begun to say that there are other ways to interpret the citizenship clause of the 14th Amendment. Should they attempt this? And again, we should believe them when they say that they will. We'll be ready immediately to challenge that in court. And I'm pretty confident that even a reactionary right-wing judiciary, the one that we have in this country, will not go so far as to overturn the 14th Amendment by judicial fiat. So I do think immigration is going to be the locus of some of the worst abuses. And again, I want to say here that we'll do everything we can in the courts, and I promise that. We'll throw every legal argument that we can into the courts, but we're going to need the public. We're going to need to see some version of what we saw in 2017 when the public rose up and went to airports, when the public rose up in response to family separation. We're going to need to see people in the streets. We're going to need to see people in blue and red communities say, hey, this isn't what we meant. You know, we didn't want, you know, criminals are in our communities. We didn't mean that we want you to raid all the workplaces in our small town and split families in half. Now, when I said before that the Trump administration is saying they don't want to separate families anymore, what they mean is that in the many families that have citizen children and non-citizen parents, if the non-citizen parents get deported, they should take their citizen children with them. Now, they'll say, we're not requiring that, but if the we are not the ones separating the family, they're the ones separating the family by having this kind of mixed family, which we have so many of in this country. And this is kind of the degree of cruelty that's being discussed here, is that, you know, it's long been the policy of administrations of both parties that in enforcing the immigration laws, we will not force families to make that kind of tragic choice, except in the case of, you know, narrow national security cases or very, very serious felony convictions. The Trump administration wants to make this routine. They want to take all of these families and essentially force them to self-deport their U.S. citizen children in order to stay with their non-citizen parents. And I do think, Michael and Steve, that that is not what most Trump voters want to see. And you do hear this when there are raids on workplaces. You see lots of interviews in small towns, places that voted for Trump overwhelmingly, saying, oh, no, they're hard workers. Those are our neighbors. Those people are not the ones that we had in mind when we talked about this. Look, there's no way to deport hundreds of thousands of people a year without attacking small communities in that way, without deporting the people who are your neighbors who are not the ones that you had in mind, people who are hardworking. And so I think it's going to be really, really important for people not to be fatalistic, not to say there's nothing we can do about it, but to object vociferously, and to make it a little bit easier for Trump to corral Congress into smoothing the way for his deportation machine.
Listening to Law and Disorder, I'm Steve Rohde, and I'm joined by co-host Michael Smith, and we're joined today by Ben Wisner from the ACLU. Ben, Donald Trump has appointed Matt Gaetz as Attorney General. In 2001, the ACLU vigorously publicized John Ashcroft's hostility to civil liberties. How does the ACLU plan to address the appointment of Matt Gaetz to Attorney General?
The ACLU is a nonpartisan organization. By national board policy, we don't take positions for or against executive branch nominations unless the board specifically votes to do that. However, we do make our views known. In 2017, when Jeff Sessions was nominated to be Attorney General, David Cole, then the National Legal Director of the ACLU, testified for hours about that nomination, about Jeff Sessions' record on civil rights and civil liberties. And while David Cole didn't tell senators how he thought they should vote, if you listen to that testimony, there was only one logical conclusion that could be drawn from it. And so we will do what we call public education around these nominations. In the last few days, it seems like Donald Trump has decided that he wants to have a cabinet made up of the bad news bears. He will probably succeed in getting at least most of his people into the office. But the idea that he has appointed to be Secretary of Defense, a Fox News host whose claim to fame is his defense of war criminals, someone for Attorney General who seems to be placed in that position for the specific view of either facilitating or staying out of the way of Donald Trump's vendettas against his political enemies, this is pretty uncharted territory. One of the things that Trump continues to teach us is that there's a difference between norms and laws. Norms can, in fact, be brushed aside, and there's not a whole lot that we can do legally to challenge that. So my sense with Gaetz is that it's not the ACLU's position that's going to be relevant. He may, in fact, have a hard time, Trump, getting his own party to ratify that particular nomination. But my expectation is that the ACLU will be extremely active in doing public education and advocacy to Congress about the positions that some of these extreme nominees hold. We may not be saying we oppose the nomination, but you will know from our comments what we think about these nominations.
Ben, it's been great having you on Law and Disorder. Before we have to let you go, because we're running out of time, can you tell our audience how they can get in touch with the ACLU? And please remind them that all politics isn't just in the courtroom.
No, that's right. In fact, politics is mostly not in the courtroom, although the courtroom has become very political. One of the strengths of the ACLU As your listeners know, is that we're not just a national organization based in Washington and New York, but we are in all 50 states. We have 53 state affiliates. Some of our larger states like California have multiple ACLU affiliates. And so the best point of contact for involvement is not through Washington or New York, unless that's where you live, but through your local ACLU. I think we're still rolling out what our plans are going to be for activating citizens. In 2017, we launched a citizen organizing movement called People Power. I don't know whether that's going to be the same mechanism that's used to for people who want to get involved in a way other than, you know, sending $10 a month contribution. But you can be sure that the ACLU, even if you're not in touch with the ACLU is going to be in touch with you.
Ben, thank you for joining Law and Disorder, and even more so, thank you for waking up every day and doing the hard work of defending our civil rights and civil liberties.
Steve and Michael, I appreciate what you do very much. Thanks for having me.
And we're sure to have you back on in the near future.
All right.
You take it easy.
Take care, guys. Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
The Jewish left is in the midst of an identity crisis, grappling with its long and complex relationship with the State of Israel in the light of the genocide in Gaza. To help us understand this fraught situation, we've invited Daniel May, the publisher of Jewish Currents magazine. He holds a PhD in modern Jewish thought and has over two decades of experience in community and labor organizing. Jewish Currents magazine was founded in 1946, but since its relaunch in 2018 with a new staff and design, it has sought to establish itself as an essential voice in the contemporary conversation. Today, the magazine covers anti-Semitism and its weaponization, the inner workings of Jewish communal organizations, the politics of Israel-Palestine on the ground and internationally, race and racialization, strategies and horizons of American left movements, the global rise of the far right, diasporic cultural expression, labor, climate, incarceration, immigration, and feminism. Daniel May, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much for having me.
Please tell us about the origins of Jewish Currents magazine, its evolution over time, and how in recent years it has covered issues of war and the pursuit of peace in Israel.
Sure. So, as you already noted, Jewish Currents was founded in 1946. It was founded with a different title. It was founded as Jewish Life, which was a magazine of the Communist Party, of the American Communist Party. It was the Jewish magazine of the Communist Party, and it was very closely tied to the Soviet Union and really was a party instrument for a decade. And then in 1956, with the revelations in Khrushchev's famous speech of Stalin's crimes, the magazine broke from the party and reorganized itself as Jewish Currents, declaring that it was going to be a magazine for a community and not a party. But through that time, it was edited by the same person, Morris Schappes, who edited it from 1946 into the 1990s. Morris Schappes was a professor at CUNY University until he was actually fired as part of the McCarthyist Red Scare. And throughout its many decades, it has remained in publication from and in print since 1946. Of course, its readership dwindled dramatically after 1956 as the Communist Party was decimated, both given the politics of the Soviet Union and, of course, the anti-communism. So through those decades, Jewish Currents was really rooted in a particular tradition, a particular community of the American Jewish socialist left, rooted deeply in a Yiddish-speaking, you know, origins in the 20s and 30s. That was the milieu and the community that made Morris Chappie's. And then in the 1990s, the magazine shifted its leadership, and Larry Bush became the editor-in-chief in the 1990s. And that generation rejected the doctrinaire socialism and communism of the earlier generation, but held on to its militant secularism. And through the early 2000s, it actually became published under the umbrella of the Workers' Circle, the old Jewish fraternity and community organization that began in the late 19th century as a home for labor organizing and Jewish socialism and secularism and Yiddish culture. And it was published under the auspices of the Workers' Circle for much of the 2000s. And then in 2018, Larry decided to pass the reins of the magazine to a younger generation. And it was relaunched, as you noted, by a group of millennial editors and writers who really saw in the magazine an opportunity to both speak to a new community of Jewish left activists who had been shaped and formed by the crash of 2008, by the wars in Iraq, by the rise of the new right in American nationalism, by the Occupy movement, and who were inspired by the legacy of American Jewish left organizing and saw themselves, and we saw ourselves, as part of a revival of that tradition, but with a very different sensibility and different priorities and concerns, given our own particular historical moment.
David Ben-Gurion wrote the following: "The Jewish people have a map which our youth and adults should try to fulfill. From the Nile to the Euphrates, one needs an opportune moment for making it happen, such as a war. Do you think that overwhelming, displacing, or even eliminating the Palestinian people was baked into the Zionist movement from the beginning?"
It's a big, big question. Refers to and sort of is related to your earlier question about how Jewish Currents has approached the question or issues of Israel-Palestine and war and peace, as you put it in your initial question. I think that there's a few things that are worth saying on this point. Certainly from the perspective of Palestinians, as Edward Said wrote memorably in an essay entitled "Zionism from the Perspective of Its Victims," Zionism has been a ongoing process of dispossession and domination. And from the Palestinian experience, I don't think there is any doubt as to the veracity of Ben-Gurion's early writing and its, and as you put it, the degree to which that project of dispossession was, quote, baked into Zionism from the start. I think that has in many ways turned out to be true, certainly from the perspective of Palestinians who have been expelled, dominated, and murdered, as we're seeing in such incredible numbers over the last year. Having said that, I do not subscribe to narratives of historical inevitability. Certainly, one of the dynamics within early Zionist thought was a dynamic of colonialism. Many early Zionist writers, including Herzl in his diaries, dreamed of transfer of the population. But there are also other things that Zionists wrote, and there were counter-movements and dissident movements and voices that opposed those sorts of policies. Those voices lost, but I do not think that those losses were, you know, somehow preordained. Like any political movement, these questions are contested, and certainly the powers that became dominant and that were seen in contemporary Israel have really taken control of the government are forces that are very clear that their aim is to create a state in which there is as many Jews as possible and as few Palestinians as possible on as much land as possible. But as far as whether that was always necessarily inherently the destiny of Zionism, again, I think I would challenge any story, any historiography that argued that the world that we have is simply the world that was inevitable. I think that one can find, again, alternate strands, whether it's someone like Martin Buber or Judas Magnus or even Hannah Arendt, or even, frankly, in Ben-Gurion's own writings, where he wrote other things that suggested that a Jewish state was not even necessary for Ben-Gurion, who's generally thought of as the sort of quintessential state figure. But historians like Dmitry Shumsky have argued that for the early Zionist, statehood was only one of several options. I do think that once statehood became the official move, the official aim of the Zionist movement in 1942, in order to have a state with a significant Jewish population, there is necessarily Palestinians must be moved off of their land, must be expelled from their land, must be dispossessed. So as soon as statehood became the official aim, then I would argue that, yes, dispossession is baked into the project. And many would argue that statehood was always the aim that of the Zionist movement. Again, for those of us who are invested in futures of equality and freedom and justice, I think that the alternate traditions are ones that are worth mining. And I don't think that, you know, the victories of the parties of explicit dispossession were inevitable, but they certainly are the ones that did win out, and they are the ones that today control the Israeli government, and we're seeing the consequences of that politics and those policies and the overwhelming destruction in Gaza, in the expansion in Lebanon, in the increasing violence in the West Bank, in the talk of annexation that has only grown in volume over the last week since Trump's election. So it is undoubtedly the case that today that, you know, Zionist politics, Israeli politics are dominated by the policies of dispossession, exploitation, and domination that Ben-Gurion's early writings that you quoted point towards.
After the UN declared Israel a state in 1948, Israel drove 750,000 Palestinians into exile during the Nakba. Before General Ariel Sharon became Israel's prime minister, he was responsible for killing thousands of Palestinians in Lebanon. He said at the time, quote, "I don't mind if after the job is done, you put me in front of a Nuremberg trial and then jail me for life. Hang me, if you like, as a war criminal. What you don't understand is the dirty work of Zionism is not yet finished. Far from it." Unquote. Daniel, today, do you think this is the mission of Israel and Netanyahu in Gaza, the West Bank, and elsewhere?
Again, it's a I think, a very deep, important, serious question, and in some respects, an easy one to answer, which is, yes, I think that is what we're seeing is very much the extension and next chapter of the kind of policies and politics that Sharon was describing. I think looking at the broader history, it's important to see that Sharon, Netanyahu are part of a particular tradition within Zionist thought and within Jewish political thought more broadly. And that tradition is revisionist Zionism. And revisionist Zionism was founded by Zev Jabotinsky in the teens and 20s. In the 1930s, Zev Jabotinsky departed from the Zionist movement more broadly because the Zionist movement was not militant, radical, and ambitious enough in his view. Benzion Netanyahu, Bibi Netanyahu's father, was Jabotinsky's secretary. So the lineage is not difficult to trace between Jabotinsky and Netanyahu and certainly Sharon. And the central argument of revisionist Zionism was that the aims of the Zionist project needed to be revised. That is why it was called revisionist Zionism. They needed to be revised to include greater Israel, which includes today parts of Jordan, parts of Lebanon, parts of Syria, and that the central means of achieving Jewish sovereignty in Greater Israel needed to be understood as military force. And Jabotinsky, in a very famous essay called The Iron Wall from the early 1920s, argued that Zionists were fooling themselves if they did not recognize that the indigenous population of Israel-Palestine, or of Palestine, Mandatory Palestine, as of course it was known then, if they did not recognize that the indigenous population of Palestine was going to resist the Zionist project and was going to resist it violently and was going to do all that they could to push the Jews back out of their Palestinian indigenous homeland. And Jabotinsky argued that the only way that the Zionist movement was going to be successful was by organizing enough overwhelming force that the resistance of the indigenous population would be revealed to be impossible, would be so thoroughly defeated that eventually the Palestinian population would simply give up and accept that the Zionist movement was here to stay. So Jabotinsky believed that negotiations with the Palestinians were futile, and he argued that Zionism had to be understood as a colonial project, and like all colonial projects, it was going to produce massive resistance on the part of the indigenous population, and the only way to respond to that resistance was through what he called an iron wall, such overwhelming force that eventually that resistance would recognize that it could not succeed. And Jabotinsky, Benzion Netanyahu, Bibi Netanyahu, Sharon, Begin in the late 1970s, the first Likud prime minister to gain power, they are all very firmly indebted and invested in this particular strand of Zionist politics. And it is undoubtedly the case that revisionist Zionism has become the dominant hegemonic ideology of current Israeli politics. Revisionist Zionism has become contemporary Zionism. It has won. And in that respect, Sharon was arguing for a particular vision that has become quite successful, that has achieved enormous power. And I certainly think that what we're seeing today in the growing military presence and most likely permanent settlement in Gaza, in, again, as I noted earlier, this expansion into Lebanon, we are seeing simply the latest chapter of that project of revisionist Zionism and the embrace of militarism and overwhelming force as the vehicle for Jewish politics and Jewish power and Jewish sovereignty. Another way to sort of put it is that revisionist Zionists accepted that the project of Zionism was going to be one of war, and they embrace that. And I think that again, what we're seeing is an embrace of war as central to project of Zionism and the Israeli state as a kind of permanent condition.
Yeah, I just wanted to add, Daniel, the observation that the Italian Mussolini, the fascist dictator of Italy in the 30s, called Jabotinsky a good fascist, and I think he was accurate in that description. This is Michael Smith. I'm with my colleague, Steve Rohde. You're listening to Law and Disorder Radio, and we're speaking with the publisher of Jewish Currents magazine, Daniel May. Daniel, in the past, unlike now, Jewish Currents was considered a Zionist magazine. Today, do you consider it anti-Zionist? And if so, how do you explain this evolution?
Well, as far as whether it's possible to be a Zionist and a socialist, there were, of course, Zionist socialist movements within Israel and movements on behalf of the kibbutzim, which were autonomous cooperative farming communities that embraced all kinds of socialist principles. And that tradition certainly was part of what attracted some of the American Jewish left to Zionism and to Israel. I would say that broadly in its earlier iterations, the editorial staff of Jewish Currents was sort of broadly supportive of the idea of a Jewish state and on behalf of Jewish self-determination in a state, and critical of the right-wing governments and right-wing policies of Israel, and very much an advocate on behalf of peace frameworks between Israel and others. I think for our generation of Jewish currents, many of us certainly describe ourselves as anti-Zionist. Many of the staff describe themselves as anti-Zionist. I don't think there's a single person on staff who thinks that the idea of a Jewish ethno-state, a state in which Jews are a permanent majority, is state that could be just and democratic under any framework. So another way to put that is that I think our guiding orientation is that we see the current regime of Israel as an apartheid regime, as a regime of Jewish supremacy in which Jews are granted rights and privileges that are denied to Palestinian, both citizens of Israel within Israel, and then, of course, Palestinians in the West Bank and in Gaza, and Palestinian refugees. There are different degrees of, you know, disenfranchisement in those different areas, but certainly the entire apparatus of the Israeli state in its current form is one that privileges Jews over non-Jews, and we see that as fundamentally unjust, and also as a framework that is bound to produce ongoing violence for as long as it remains guiding framework for the regime. Now, many would say that that means that we're an anti-Zionist magazine. Related to what I said earlier, I do not use that term to describe the magazine, because there are various, certainly readers and writers and editors who don't use that term to describe themselves. For example, Peter Beinart, who describes himself as a cultural Zionist, rooted in a particular tradition that values Jewish culture, language, autonomy in Israel-Palestine, but rejects the notion that those things need to be or ought to be protected through state power. So Peter is somebody who rejects the idea of a Jewish state, so many would say that therefore he is an anti-Zionist, but he sees himself as part of a tradition that is connected to a non-state or even anti-statist tradition of Zionist thought that I mentioned earlier, that was prevalent before the declaration of statehood in 1942 as the aim of the Zionist movement in the 20s and 30s. So I would say we as a magazine are guided by certain fundamental commitments and principles to equality, freedom, historical justice. And we want to facilitate and platform a conversation around what does it mean to embody and live out those principles and commitments in contemporary Jewish life and politics. And for all of us, I think that leads to a rejection of the idea of permanent Jewish hegemony and Jewish supremacy. If some people would describe that as anti-Zionism, I'll let them describe that as anti-Zionism. Again, I think that the more important question is what are your commitments, what are your principles, rather than what is the, you know, particular ism that you're going to label yourself with to describe those principles and commitments.
Daniel, what has your magazine and its contributors had to say in recent years about the conflation of anti-Semitism and criticism of Israel and its policies?
I would just say that we have come to a very strange point in our social and political conversation when simply insisting on basic equality, on basic political rights for all people that live under a particular regime, that position is seen as anti-Semitic. Obviously, to be critical of the Israeli government and the Israeli policies is not anti-Semitic. I think very, very few people would even make that argument. You will hear the argument that being an anti-Zionist, being opposed to the idea of a Jewish state, is an anti-Semitic position because it denies to Jews, you know, a right to self-determination that is granted to all other peoples. There's a lot to say about that particular argument. I will just note that the core commitment of the staff, writers, and us as a magazine is to, as I said earlier, is to basic equality and to historical justice. What that means is everybody living under a state that declares itself a democracy should have the right to vote. Everybody living under that state, when tried for the same crime, should go to the same courts. That is, neither of those things are operative in Israel today, needless to say. You know, communities that live several yards, 100 yards from each other in the West Bank. If you're a Jew living in a settlement, then you can vote for the government that rules over your life. If you're a Palestinian living in a village, then of course you cannot vote for the government that rules over your life. That is patently unjust. To insist that it is unjust and that the state should grant basic equality of political rights to all people that live under it, that does mean that the state would no longer have a permanent Jewish majority. That position is not only not anti-Semitic, I would argue that it is a position that any Jew of conscience, aware of their own history as a persecuted people, as a disenfranchised people, as a people that had been in various ways shut out of all kinds of political arrangements for equality, it is a manifestly Jewish position. And more Jews, particularly young Jews, are seeing that there is a serious contradiction between saying in, for example, an American context, that it's our role as Jews to struggle against ethno-nationalism in the United States, but to support ethno-nationalism in Israel, that is morally and politically inconsistent and incoherent. And a consistent position is one that says that in a democracy, all people should have equal rights. And if people have been dispossessed of their homes through forced expulsion, they have a right to return to their homes and a right of recognition of that return. These are principles that are enshrined in international law. Part of the reason they're enshrined in international law is specifically because of the Jewish experience in the 20th century. And to insist that Israel or any other state simply abide by these basic principles is not only, again, manifestly not an anti-Semitic position, I would argue that it's the only position that any Jew aware of their history and the moral and political obligations that come with it can, you know, honorably stand behind.
Before Stephen and I have to say goodbye to you, could you tell us how people can get in touch with Jewish Currents?
Sure thing. JewishCurrents.org. Come visit the site, sign up to the newsletter, and of course, subscribe. Also, you can listen to our podcast, On the Nose.
Thank you, Daniel. Appreciate your being on Law and Disorder. You and Jewish Currents have redeemed the valuable heritage of humanitarian Judaism. Thank you.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Daniel, for joining us on Law and Disorder.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
And I thank our listeners for joining us here today on Law and Disorder, and I urge you all to visit our website, lawanddisorder.org. There you'll learn ways to support the show and spread the message of the show, and we'll appreciate that as well.
How does it feel when it's quiet and calm? And will I be denied? How will it feel when it's time to move on? Mother says, kneel and pray. When it gets hard, I will run those leaves. Life can be so unkind. I will be found on the edge of the world, where there'll be no one around. Oh, solid ground. Solid ground. Solid ground. How does it feel to be on your own? No one to understand. when it gets dark, I won't know no fear. Life can be so unkind. Hanging around on the edge of the world, finally no one around. Whoa, would you help me? I don't understand. Is it over? Am I losing solid ground? Solid ground. Solid ground. Thank you.